Hello and welcome to On Sacred Ground. I'm your host, Kai Armand, and this is the LMC Radio Network. You're tuning into a show where we are broadcasting the voices of the dead and of the land by weaving together history, ethnography, and spiritual experience. And if you're tuning in online and having technical issues, remember that you can listen in by calling in by your phone or Skype to 657-383-0525. That's 657-383-0525. And to those of you who are listening live and are in the chat room at blogtalkradio.com, welcome and thank you so much for tuning in. This is our 26th episode of On Sacred Ground, broadcasting newly live at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific on this Wednesday, September 30th, 2015. I know it might take a second for people to get used to it, but we have actually just moved from our Saturday afternoon slot on the LMC Radio Network to a Wednesday evening slot. And I'll tell you, it certainly has a different feel to it. Saturday afternoons are sort of ripe and alive where I live, and things are much calmer and cooler, and I sort of get an understanding of my my colleagues and their shows on the LMC Radio Network who have their shows at night. I understand why they usually are sipping something while they're on their shows. In addition to us being in this new slot, again, Wednesday nights, live at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, I also want to apologize for the not having a show last week, and that's something we'll be getting into as to why a little bit later in the episode, because this episode will be discussing ritual and ceremony. And I happened to be involved in some ritual and ceremony actually just this past Saturday in a really unique geographic location. And I do a lot of traveling. And let me tell you, where I was for this period of ritual and ceremony was a unique place. I will be getting into that again a little bit later. But today is a call-in show. Tonight is a call-in show. So if you have any questions or comments or would like to share some of your stories or ideas about ritual and ceremony, do call in. Again, the number is 657-383-0525. And before we get into the topic, we'll be starting, as we always do, with a selection from the book Earth Prayers from Around the World, 365 Prayers, Poems, and Invocations for Honoring the Earth. And this poem is actually an anonymous poem from the Hellenistic period. And it reads, "We bless you, cicada, high in the branches. You sip a dewdrop and whistle like a king. What you see is yours, all the soft meadows and furry mountains, yet you do no harm to the farmer's field, and men exalt you as the voice of summer. You are loved by Muses and Apollo himself, who gave you clear song. Wise child of the earth, old age doesn't waste you. Unfeeling and bloodless, you are like a god." A little summer energy as we leave summer and really step into fall. A lot of people recently posting about pumpkin spice lattes and the autumn equinox, which we just had, as well as the neo-pagan Sabbath known as Mabon that usually falls right around September 15th. And really, this is a really interesting time for us to be having a topic such as ritual and ceremony as we head into the winter months that are most marked, not only in the Christian tradition or the American traditions of Thanksgiving and Christmas, but the Jewish tradition of Yom Kippur and Sukkot. Rosh Hashanah. There are so many holidays over these months that are lumped together, and we sort of think of them as, oh, my kids will be home from school, or, oh, I get a day off, and, you know, the stores won't be open, or I have to buy a lot of food, and, oh, there will be a lot of family coming around, and, you know, sort of these convenience logistics around these ideas, and, of course, the aesthetic conversations as well. But I don't think that we necessarily, as communally, think a lot about the power of this time, that there are so many rituals being done that are mainstream, that are more than accepted by our culture in the West, but encouraged by our culture in the West, whereas in so many other areas of our lives, we're kind of devoid of ritual. And this is, I guess, a good point to talk about how this episode is in no way meant to be exhaustive or definitive on these topics. People have been writing about ritual and ceremony to understand and come to definitions about these things for a very, very, very long time. And it's near impossible. We have a lot of theories, ritual and ceremony. I have some of my own. So this episode is more about exploring some of those theories around ritual and ceremony, some of those definitions that people have arrived at, but more than arriving at an exact definition, this episode is more, again, about exploring, but also exploring the power and necessity of it. We might not know exactly what it is, but we know we need it. We know it's really, really, really important. Before I get there, let's talk a little bit about, I guess, definition. So, on one hand, ritual, in mainstream layman's terms, can be applied to just about anything. A lot of people, just your average Joe walking down the street, he'll recognize a ritual. You know, he'll say, hey, you know, I saw someone praying near a candle. It seemed like that was a ritual. That there was some way in which that was an outside of time and space experience that I saw that seemed like someone was engaging ritually in something. Ritual, some people who coming from a more performance studies background, which I myself come from, will talk about even brushing one's teeth. It's something that we do every morning. That ritual is actually based in habit. That whatever we do habitually is ritual. That smoking a cigarette is ritual. And some people will say that that is a really loose definition of ritual that really misses the point. That ritual is something that they actually put in contrast to ceremony. That ritual is a time in which we intentionally rend and rip apart, quote, that the status quo, whatever is going on, whatever is I consider to be stability, whatever is the status quo in my relationship to a person, a spirit, my community, the community's relationship to nature, the way that my community is interacting, this needs to be torn apart and ripped asunder, and that's ritual. And ceremony is actually when we choose to step into the status quo and we reaffirm the status quo. Things have been a little haywire. Things have been a bit crazy. Maybe I forgot who I am. Maybe we forgot who we are. So we're going to enter into ceremony to reaffirm our values and those things that we know. We're going to step back into those truths that we know as ceremony and its cousin ritual. And I think that, I love the wide variety of definitions and possibilities. I myself, I sort of accept all of them. I don't step into any particular place with them. But one thing I am very strongly about is that ritual is not only religious. It's not only spiritual. There are public, secular rituals all the time. And in fact, to me, ritual is a technology. And that's kind of why I love ritual so much. And I think it's vital that we understand it. Because, for instance, if someone brings a television into your home and turns it on and then, you know, leaves your house, gets into a van, and then controls your television from that van, then you got a whole lot of stuff going on, and you're going ooh and ah, but you're not understanding what it is. There's something very powerful in your home in this sort of analogy I'm creating. There's something very powerful in your home, in your space, that's affecting you that you don't understand. You don't understand how it works. You don't feel like you have any control over it. All you get to do is be at the whim of it. You just get to be in awe of it. And when it comes to ritual, even though I mentioned before the idea of, you know, we have all these rituals like Christmas and Thanksgiving, these are wonderful familial, or they have the potential to be, familial, communal spaces, times, liminal spaces and times. We'll get to that word in a moment. But we are surrounded by ritual all the time. We are surrounded by political ritual, the pomp and circumstance of patriotism and nationalism, and we are encouraged to engage in them with speech and gesture, pledging our allegiance to symbols and singing songs and applauding this person and booing this person without fully understanding what we are engaged in and the power of it. That we are not just thinking, rational, logical individuals, but we are moved. We are moved by beauty. We are moved by symbol. We are moved by gesture. We are moved by communal interaction with symbol and gesture. So to me, much like magic, much like consciousness and modes of exploring consciousness, from shamanic, you know, techniques to entheogens, etc. These are technologies, very much like ritual is a technology. And the better we understand ritual as a technology, the better we can understand what we as biological and feeling beings are engaged in, and the sooner we can notice it and we can get an understanding of why Donald Trump is in the lead of the Republican Party, we can understand that it's not just, you know, that it's not just logic and rationality at play in our lives and in the lives of our fellow citizens, but there are thought and feeling and intensity and gesture. There are so many more things at play in this technology of ritual. And in addition to political ritual, there's performance as ritual. For those who frequent the idea, or at least, you know, post them online, they used to be more popular a few years ago, flash mobs. Flash mobs, to me, are very ritualistic. They completely upend the status quo. You got a whole lot of people showing up to do something together that completely upends the status quo of time, of space. Usually it's happening in the middle of the day when there's a real set order. There's that 9-to-5 order playing out. But instead, you know, and you're just grabbing your lunch at Union Square thinking about how much you hate your boss, and then 30 people start jamming to Thriller. And it completely just rips apart your sense of the day, your sense of what's normal, your sense of what's proper. It just completely upends all of that in time and in space. To me, those kinds of experiences are really ritualistic, even if they don't repeat themselves. Just that conversation of how time is ripped apart and space is ripped apart. It's a powerful technology. And then there's also rituals that are inspired by other rituals. I'm inspired, for instance, in this moment by Reverend Billy and the Stop Shopping Choir. Reverend Billy is a performance artist who is his work is inspired by this sort of American Baptist ritual performance of charisma and fervency, and he has a whole choir to back him up, but their message is about environmentalism and anti-capitalism. And they hop out of vans in their robes and run over to in a Walmart parking lot and start singing gospel songs about community and community being more important than capitalism. If you don't know about Reverend Billy, he has been doing this work for so long, you are missing out. Go Google Reverend Billy and the Stop Shopping Choir. Give them money. Buy their albums. See if they're showing up in your town or city. Credible ritual disruptors. with no shame in their game. Reverend Billy has been banned from Starbucks all over the world because he constantly walks into Starbucks, stands on the counter, and exorcises their cash registers, and is dragged out by the police. And recently, he and the Stop Shopping Choir have gone to the Tate Museum in London to protest, ritually protest, using this dynamic, fervent energy that they've created and cultivated to protest the museum's relationship with BP oil. And they, you know, very much, you know, a conversation of resurrection and pulling on all of those symbolic elements that we know and love, whether or not we're Christian, you know, simply being in the West, to create a huge statement around our health and our planet's health. So here we have the idea of secular rituals. We've been talking about political rituals. And then, of course, there are rituals that are rituals like coming-of-age rituals. People will absolutely, you know, point that out as a ritual, the idea that many people at the age of 21 in the United States, they perform the ritual or ceremony, depending on that. Well, it's ritual if we're going with the idea of upending the status quo, of getting their quote-unquote first drink. They can now show that bartender, that bouncer, hey, I'm 21 on my ID, and it's sort of expected that you're going to get wildly trashed on some alcohol. And, you know, and that's sort of a coming-of-age ritual in the West. Another coming-of-age ritual are bar and bat mitzvahs. A young Jewish person at the age of around 13 years old is said to be an adult, and people gather and celebrate them, and they show the community what they know and who they are, and it's a rite of passage. There's also hazing rituals when you enter into a fraternity or sorority. You're going through a series of tests to prove your worthiness or your allegiance to it. So we have all of these ideas about ritual, and what brought me to ritual, actually, was I was in community college, and I was on my way to trying to understand what I wanted to major in, and I had always had a really strong love of theater, and I was trying to tell myself that I wasn't going to do that to myself, that I wasn't going to major in theater in school, that was, let's just not be silly. So I decided that really the next best thing for me was ecology. I had always had this, I'd always loved National Geographic, and I had always loved travel. And even though I wasn't someone who really excelled in the sciences, I felt like, you know, ecology, an ecologist is an honorable way of being in the world, and it speaks to my values. And hey, if I have to learn, if I have to get better at science in order to be able to participate in the world in this way, let me do that. So I took a class at community college in Ecology 101, and it was a bit difficult because, not difficult subject matter wise, but more difficult because I was having to really dig into the harm we've caused our planet. And I'm sort of sitting there and I'm thinking, don't we know this stuff already? Don't we know we're not supposed to be doing this stuff? Don't we know how bad we're being? I mean, this is really stupid. Like, we're being stupid to be doing this to our own home. I mean, I usually, you know, provide the example of if you walked into someone's home and it was someone who took a crap in their living room and regularly smeared it on the walls, you might worry about that person's mental well-being. Well, we're sort of doing that in our own home on the earth, yet we're considering ourselves sane and rational. So I started sort of asking myself, what's going on here? And I don't know exactly how I arrived at it. Well, I do know. The way I arrived at it was because at the time, I considered myself to be a practicing neo-Wiccan. By neo-Wiccan, I mean I was not initiated in any of the Wiccan group traditions, the lineage traditions, Alexandrian, Black Forest, Gardnerian. I was sort of following Wiccan tenets as best I could, practicing as a solitary practitioner, inspired by those tenets. I'm performing rituals at the Sabbats and wearing a pentacle on my, you know, neck very proudly. So what was happening from that was I was having to sort of write and these rituals or piecemeal them together, you know, look online and say, oh, shoot, it's Maven, it's Samhain, what am I going to do? And I'd find, you know, five rituals and I'd cut and paste from them and I'd say, ooh, I like that, and ooh, that's too expensive, and ooh, okay, this works. I can sort of memorize this. Maybe I'll have to bring like a cheat sheet with me, which won't be too sexy in front of the moon, but I guess the moon will forgive me. And I'm going to make this happen. I'm going to do something, you know, something that feels right for me, give myself some pagan church time. But having done this for a while, I was definitely, and having done so effectively, having learned how to move myself in ritual space, having learned how to create ritual space for myself in a way that I knew would move me, give myself and the magic and environment that I needed, I was beginning to understand the technology of ritual. And what poured out of that was this thinking of, well, what's going on with environmentalism and our values and morals as a culture? We have all of these laws. We know we're not supposed to be hurting each other. We know we're not supposed to be hurting the earth. So what's going on? And it sort of dawned on me this idea of we're not ritualizing those values. Again, we're more than walking. We are more than flesh suits for brains. We have sensory needs and input and possibilities for a reason. We are far more complex and interesting than walking brains, as our culture tries to tell us that we are. And as advertisers know, again, but, you know, we're talking about the technology of ritual. We're also talking about the technology of symbol and gesture and culture. We need to be able to take these things back into our hands if we really want to change our world. So I was realizing, you know, we have these values, but who cares if they're written down? Who cares if a man with a gun is going to come over and tell me to stop? The truth is that until I'm embodying these values, until they are a part of my body in a regular way, how can these values ever really be a part of my life? You know, it's one thing to say, don't pollute the ocean, but we live in a culture in which we are not able to actually see the connection between food and the ocean. You know, the capitalism renders that connection obsolete. We don't see it. We don't see the tree that made our IKEA furniture. So we can just consume, consume, consume. We don't see things in context. So the idea of, hey, don't pollute the ocean is kind of moot. We're kind of like children in a way. We're talking about our childlike selves, the part of us that wants to be engaged with ritual and scent and gesture. So the idea of don't pollute the ocean, you know, what are you talking about? So completely a different idea from, I can't pollute the ocean. I know this ocean is my mom. Every year we go down to this ocean and make offerings to it, thanking it for the abundance of fish that it's brought us, thanking it for being calm so that our moms and dads who travel on it were able to come home and take care of us again. That's ritual. And that's ritual engagement. We're not embodying these values. And that is what brought me to say, wow, I think I had to look at ritual again. Sort of another idea is, it's one thing to say, don't kill your fellow citizen. It's another thing to say, I can't kill this person. I know that this person is my brother or sister from another mother. Every month I pass this cup of wine to them and we sip from it. How can I hurt this person? So this was the conversation that got me into wanting to major in, which I did in college, major in ritual, and seeing, again, that idea of how I myself was able to create ritual experiences for myself made me actually pair it with theater and look at theater and ritual as interrelated subjects. And I wasn't the first person to do that. Actually, one of the people who really pioneered that study of the relationship between ritual and theater was anthropologist Victor Turner in the 1960s. And he is not the person who invented the word liminal, but he really used it a lot and cultivated our current understanding of the word liminal. And what liminal is liminal is that moment in ritual in which time and space really disappear. That usually ritual is broken down into at least three stages. The preparation of space, we're doing this delineation of space, that now the space that we are in is going to be separate. It's separate in terms of everyday space. It's separate in terms of time. This is something completely different here than our usual. We might delineate that space by casting a circle, as is done in ceremonial magic and Wicca. We might delineate that space by changing our clothes, by taking a bath, by stepping into clothing that we don't usually step into. And usually there's some climax of the ritual, some luminous moment, some moment in ritual, especially, of course, religious and quote-unquote spiritual rituals. And then there's the sort of coming down, there's the closure, and the return to the norm. And the liminal is that space in between when we really are neither here nor there, where one might argue the real stuff happens. And another term that I sort of came across during these studies was spect actor, which comes back to that idea I was saying before of my ability to, through tremendous trial and error, mind you, I was practicing theater. I was practicing solo theater for myself in my days as a practicing Neo-Wiccan. And the idea of a spect actor is someone who is both they're a spectator because they're waiting for something to happen. They are going to be engaged. They're going to be full of awe. Something is going to happen that's outside of their control, whether it's just them being moved in some way, or some spirit is going to come down, or the environment is just going to exude something for them. But then they're also the actor because they're the one who's created it. They're the one who has literally created the space for this to happen, for them to be moved in this way. And spect actor also goes to, you know, used far more in performance circles that are employing ritual tactics than in actual, you know, spiritual rituals. I don't know of any spirit workers who use the term spect actor, but it's a helpful way to understand what's sort of happening in, I guess, probably just most rituals. And if we're going to come back to that definition of ceremony from before, that idea of stepping into the status quo versus and the rending of status quo, Wicca is a perfect example of the use of ceremony, because in Wicca, you have this idea of eight Sabbats, of eight holidays that are really, really important, and you also have 13 moons. And so much of Wicca is about, at least Neo-Wicca, is about attuning yourself to the cycles of nature. That, you know, we were living in modern time, we're living in urban centers, or even not, obviously, when we look in indigenous cultures, we see people performing ceremony. They're taking steps, ritual actions, to align themselves with the cycles of the seasons, that kind of status quo. So this is sort of a general overview of all of the ways, not all of them, but many of the ways that people explore and think about ritual and ceremony. And when we come back, we will take a deeper look at a couple of movers and shakers in our own world when it comes to these topics, as well as what happened to me this past weekend. So we'll be right back.
In the woods there grew a tree, and a fine, fine tree was he.
And on that tree there was a limb, and on that limb there was a branch, and on that branch there was a nest, and in that nest there was an egg, and in that egg there was a bird, and on that bird a feather came, and all that feather was a bed. And on that bed there was a girl, and on that girl there was a man, and on that man there was a sea, and on that sea there was a boy, and on that boy there was a man, and on that man there was a great, and on that great there grew a tree. And on that tree there was a limb, and on that limb there was a branch, and on that branch there was a nest, and in that nest was an egg, and in that egg was a bird, from that bird a feather came, and all that feather was a bird. And on that bed there was a girl, and on that girl there was a man, from that man there was a sea, from that sea there was a boy, from that boy there was a man, from that man there was a great, from that great there grew.
Acknowledge the one that was directed in the 70s. It is the only one, it is the only version of that movie that I will speak of ever. And it's excellent. It's amazing. The movie itself, if you have never seen The Wicker Man, please see it. And as I was planning this episode, it came to mind because I was thinking about ritual in relation to spell work and how spell work is often the idea of spell work, magic, etc., is often the idea of performing an act toward a very specific intended outcome. And rituals absolutely can hold the same space, but I feel that more often rituals are more about, are less about an intended goal than the intended goal being to connect or pass through, to pass through a space or to connect with something within that space that's created. And I love that song, Maypole, because in the movie, there's a reenactment of singing around what is a maypole. And a maypole in ancient European practices and neo-pagan practices is sort of the center of the Beltane ceremony that takes place in May. Beltane being a holiday associated with fertility and sexual union, and often participants are dancing with ribbons that they are wrapping around a large phallic symbol. And that song, during it, the children in the movie are performing that exact act while singing about the cycles of nature, how this tree relates to a human being, to two human beings, three human beings if we consider the sun, and how that sun who dies is then becomes a part of a tree again. Singing about the cycles of nature, and they're singing it cyclically, and there's this attunement. This is a ritual of attunement, attunement to the cycles of nature. And in this movie, The Wicker Man, the main character is a police officer from Scotland who's come across this island called Summer Isle, and this island has been practicing a sort of resurrected form of European paganism, and he really can't stand it. But you're not seeing throughout the movie tons of individuals performing spells in their homes that are freaking him out. You're seeing all of these community rituals and how ritual directs the community's interactions with themselves and their environment. And as little as he, as much as he hates it, he himself finds himself involved in some of the community rituals. Spoiler alert! One of the great champions of ritual in our current age is the Dagora elder Maladoma Somme. Maladoma Somme, if you haven't read his work, do read it. He has books such as Ritual, I believe it's Ritual, Healing, Community, and Magic, and then there's The Healing Wisdom of Africa. Everything he writes is amazing. And he's a Dagora elder whose purpose, it was divined when in his culture, was to become friends with strangers, to make friends with the outsiders. And as a child, he actually was sent away / kidnapped, I believe, by missionaries and found himself studying in a European nation, really, you know, separate from his people and unable to go through those initiatory rites that would make him an adult in his tribe. And when he returned, because he eventually got to return, he then went through those rituals to become an adult amongst his people. And there's a lot of pain involved in that, being removed from his people, being brought back to them, and then being sent away yet again. Because his life was not to be amongst them. His life was to be amongst the strangers. So Maladoma Somme actually lives here in the United States. He travels back to his tribe in West Africa a couple of times a year, but he has been involved here writing and cultivating community. And he often writes about the shock that he encountered upon seeing the lack of ritual in the West. And that he feels that it's sort of one of our primary ills that we don't have ritual, that our ritual experience is very limited, and that we're not really utilizing this technology. And I sort of was making a point earlier in the show that we're also sort of being coaxed and canoodled by rituals that we don't fully understand. So he makes a big deal about ritual in his books, and he especially makes a big deal about the ritual of grief, about the lack of grieving rituals and space to grieve and time to grieve in our culture. And I think this is particularly potent. I've been thinking a lot about Jamaica, the island of Jamaica, recently speaking to the prime minister and sort of the upper echelons of politics in Britain and saying, you know, it's really time for reparations. We gained our freedom in 1962, I believe, but, you know, we are nowhere near where you are as a nation. And so much of where you are is because of the exploitation of us as Jamaicans for a very, very long time, for centuries, as well as the exploitation of African bodies. So what about those reparations? And it really pained me to read that the prime minister sort of outright said, well, first of all, he did not apologize for slavery, and just sort of outright said, I really don't think that reparations is the answer here. And rather than really speaking to the people as to their grief and their pain and their desire for justice, started the conversation by saying, you know, I'm so proud, we're so proud that Britain was one of the first countries to abolish slavery, which is sick. That's literally sick when Britain was so heavily involved in the transatlantic slave trade. So, yeah, they were one of the first ones to stop the evil that was occurring after having benefited from it for so long. And we just see time and time again, whether it's amongst indigenous peoples of the Americas, African-descended peoples in the West Indies, this refusal to even look, this refusal to let alone take actions to rectify the pain, let alone take actions toward reconciliation so that real healing can take place, this refusal to even acknowledge the pain. And there's always the outcry, just move on. No one just moves on. There is no just moving on. Reconciliation and healing require time, space, and witness, the energy of witness. And we think of the Nuremberg trials, where people were being called into to be held accountable for the crimes during the Holocaust and World War II. We can see those as a ritual of witness, of people stepping forward and saying, I saw you. I saw you. I saw you. You were sitting behind that desk. You played a part in this. And I saw you. I saw you, little girl, who lost your family. I saw you. And here we are, still in so many ways, refusing to see. So rituals of witness are another form of ritual, very, very powerful form of ritual that is related to grief and healing and reconciliation, whether it be for a lone individual or for a larger group of people. And some of the writings of Maladoma Sumay on ritual come from his book, The Healing Wisdom of Africa. One of the things he says is, healing, ritual, and community, these three elements are vitally linked. I remember a white man involved in an African-style ritual in England who was asked to play the djembe. He played the drum almost nonstop for 10 hours. Later on, he said that after a few hours, he found himself in an African village drumming with a community of African villagers. And the energy was so strong that he didn't realize that time was flowing. When we talk of ritual, we are talking about the interweaving of individual persons and gifts into a community that interacts with the forces of the natural world. We are talking of the gathering of people with a clear healing vision and a trusting intent toward the forces of the invisible world. In another section of the book, he says, ritual is a dance with spirit, the soul's way of interacting with the other world. It is a time of unplanned, unforeseeable, yet orderly disorder. One thing I'll never forget is a time where I myself, and excuse me if I told the story on the show already, was conducting a ritual while in college. I was sort of the head of the pagan collective in college, and it was Samhain. We were just on the verge of the mainstream holiday Halloween that amongst neo-pagans and Wiccans is known as Samhain. And there's sort of less emphasis on dressing up and getting candy and more emphasis on communing with the dead, this idea that the veil between the worlds in October and early November is thinner than any other time. Which is why actually we have that idea of that ritual of dressing up and getting candy. It's sort of an ancient European tradition of sort of dressing up like the ghouls and ghosts that are said to wander about at that time so that one blends in with them more easily. And at the time I had registered for a class in ritual anthropology, and I dropped out because I thought it was a little boring. But before I dropped out, I had told the teacher that I told the teacher, hey, I am dropping out because I'm already studying this stuff and I'm already sort of a spirit worker. And she kind of ran with that and was like, oh, my God, you're a druid. And I don't know where she got that from. But she told all the students, and I said, you know, I'm leaving the class, but we're going to be conducting a ritual for Samhain if people in the class would like to come. And this was at a sister school of my college. My college was very small. This was at a much larger college a few miles down the road. And she said, great, I'll tell the people. And I wasn't sure if she did or not, but we had planned this really elaborate ritual that was going to take place deep in the woods of my college. And my college has extensive woods around it, to the extent that we called it the Shire. And we really had created this beautiful entryway with sort of candles lighting the way. You had to cross a small creek to get to where this ritual was going to be. A friend of mine had built a sort of straw man, more of a Lammas ritual thing, but hey, it worked. Because we were sending it, the idea, part of the idea of Samhain is that the horned one, the king, the lord, is dying. He is crossing over into the other world. And we wanted to build something where we can all give him our fears to take to the other side. And a friend of mine had built this big, beautiful sort of corn husk man for us to put little pieces of paper in during the ritual. So we're sitting in we're sitting in one of the centers where we meet, and we're all dressed up and we're all ready to go, and I think there's 10 of us, and I'm a little sad because I was hoping that there would be more people. We had put a lot of time and energy into this ritual, and someone else had already gone ahead to prepare the bonfire, and we were like, okay, well, we're ready, we're going to go. And at that very moment, I hear a knock on the door, and I open it, and there's like 30 other people. 30 other kids that teacher had actually told her students, and they told their friends, and they had all come over to our college for this ritual. And I remember calling my friend and being like, prepare the space. We have a lot more people than we thought. So here we already have that orderly disorder at play. Usually, you know, in many of the neo-pagan rituals that I've conducted or that I've been a part of, that kind of orderly disorder, that disorder energy comes from a meditative moment where maybe you don't know what you want to give to the fire. Maybe you don't know what you need to let go of. Maybe you don't know the gift that the goddess has for you. So we're going to be led into a little bit of a meditative space and speak to spirit and find out that thing. There's that openness, that, being a spect actor, I've provided the space and now I'm going to sort of sit back and receive. So here we have the disorder starting a little bit earlier than expected. And they were calling my friend and just saying, you know, we've got them coming. And I'm thinking, how are we going to get all of these people into these woods? Okay, they're going to get lost. And it was so magical. It was so magical to the point that it still brings me to tears today, the way that light and darkness interplayed with each other. As some people were holding candles toward the front that lit the way for people in darkness in the back as they stepped over broken twigs, this huge mass of people moving into the woods, and certain people who were more agile and woodsy and outdoorsy helped others cross the creek, this very thin log, so that everyone made it over okay, and how it worked out so swimmingly. And as we arrived at the center, and you know, enough space was there for everyone to gather in a circle, and we, you know, we did the ritual, and we had people calling the quarters, and all of these energies were happening. I'm actually just remembering right now a friend of mine who was there. I totally forgot was there, and I have to reach out to him and just reminisce over this moment. I'm so grateful that he was able to participate. And everyone, you know, goes into their light meditative state and finds out, yeah, this is the thing I need to give to this effigy to take over to the other side. I'm ready to let this thing die. And we all write it down on pieces of paper, and we all stick it into the straw man, and we put it in the fire, and we start singing a song. The earth, the air, the fire, the water returns. We're letting him go, and he is not burning. he is not burning. And I'm like, oh, shit. Because it kind of sucks. You just have these people write down these fears that they're ready to let go of, and they're not being let go of. There's no ritual disposal happening. And I'm just, you know, as a theater person and as a ritualist, I'm like, oh, man, this really sucks. I'm feeling a little embarrassed. I'm feeling a little sheepish. And we're all realizing they've just been singing for a long time, and this thing ain't burning. And at that moment, one of my friends stops singing and looks at someone else in the circle and just goes over and hugs them. And then someone else started hugging someone else. And then everyone just started hugging all of these people, many of whom did not know each other, just hugging and then crying. And while this is happening, one of my friends takes that straw man and lays him down in the fire so that he could burn more easily. And to me, that perfect moment of that orderly disorder of something scary. Because it is scary. It's scary to let go, but that's often the point of ritual, that letting go part, and how things worked out even better and more, that the even greater intimacy was created, that ritual literally became legendary. And the teacher emailed me to say that her students were so they came back and they couldn't stop talking about it because they were so moved. That wasn't me. I didn't do anything. That was a space was created and the orderly disorder took place. And people in that moment, as spect actors, knew exactly what to do. They just followed their intuition and God happened. There's another story I want to tell when we get back from our next break. But speaking of God happening in a space, I found myself really led to, by many signs, to go to New Orleans this past weekend. And I had the wonderful opportunity of finally making it down to that city. And there, the main reason was because of a fete, a Haitian Vodou ritual that would be taking place that I had the wonderful opportunity of participating in. It was my second fete. The other one I had experienced was here in New York a couple of years ago. It was wonderful to sort of look at the technology of the ritual. Again, space is created with symbols and offerings, statues and candles, the potomitan, which looks a lot like a maypole, come to think of it. But the potomitan sort of being that central figure in many Haitian Vodou fetes that is mirrored around the world in other forms of like a world tree. And it's said that the potomitan, that the loa, the mysteries of Haitian Vodou, that they travel down that potomitan, and that is how they come into the ritual to celebrate with the participants. And ritual, fete, really is a very appropriate term for a Haitian Vodou ritual because it is a party. It's a celebration. It's a celebration of these mysteries. And there's this orderly disorder that's taking place as usually at the beginning, everyone is very heavily involved. Things feel really religious. There's a litany of Catholic prayers in many lineages, in my lineage especially, that are said to prepare the space. And then things get a little looser as things move on. You know, there's a bartender on call the whole time. At least at this fete there was. Bartender on call up the whole time. People are kind of stepping in, stepping out. And people are sort of taking turns, the mambos and ungans, making sure that things are continuing and making sure that the heat is on, that the right songs are being sung, that the reglement, which is the protocol, the order, in which the spirits are called, because that's really the main thing that's happening in this form of ritual is that the spirits are being celebrated and called, and some of them will come in possession. And that's really awesome because then the participants will be able to be blessed in person or receive direct messages from these Lua, some of whom you know that they are honoring at home in their own way, ritually, mediumistically, but there's nothing like, hey, this Lua is right here to give me this message or call me out or to, you know, take this cologne and bless my head. That kind of moment, again, of we prepared the space and now we're going to let God happen. And it was a very, very beautiful set. New Orleans is a very unique city with, obviously, that's known for its spiritual background. But it's known, actually, not so much for Haitian voodoo as it's known for rituals of New Orleans voodoo, which is a completely different tradition than Haitian voodoo, although many of the spirits of Haitian voodoo show up in New Orleans voodoo, not the other way around. Marie Laveau is one of the her tomb is one of the main reasons one of the main attractions in New Orleans. And if you don't know about Marie Laveau, definitely look her up. She was known as the voodoo queen. And people often speak of her as a spellcaster par excellence, but also a hairstylist who may or may not have gotten some of the information that she knew for her divination through the gossip that she picked up while doing women's hair. But it was not talked about as much, but is of course tremendous importance to me, was that she was a ritualist, was that she utilized drama and theater as spiritual performance in her work, especially during one of the most important holidays in the New Orleans voodoo tradition, which is known as St. John's Eve, taking place in June, and that she would go down to the bayou, she'd go down to the river, and it said that there would be thousands of people there to watch her perform this ritual, that even just their watching was sacred for them. And I believe that she performed many head washes there. And now she, Marie Laveau, from my understanding, passed away in the late 1800s. Again, New Orleans voodoo has many of the spirits in their pantheon from Haitian voodoo. However, in New Orleans voodoo pantheon, there are also many spirits that are local to New Orleans as well. One of those spirits being the folk hero, Annie Christmas. Now, Annie Christmas was a folk hero of New Orleans who became part of the New Orleans voodoo pantheon. She is known as a Lua in New Orleans voodoo. And she's often thought of as a female Ogun, Ogun being the sort of sword-bearing Orisha of the Yoruban peoples, who is associated with technology and iron and the sort of moving forward of civilization, in a way. And Annie Christmas legend has it that she was a 7-foot-tall woman who weighed hundreds of pounds. And in this, and in her being someone who worked the docks of the Mississippi River, strongly defied gender norms. She did dress in traditionally feminine attire. She's especially known for having worn a long string of pearls. But she was a woman who was so big and was working the docks there. And because of her legendary actions and stature, of course, she became a part of this pantheon, and she is called down in ritual in some New Orleans voodoo houses. And I have the privilege of having a song associated with her that I'd love to share with you because it speaks to that, because it's so ecstatic. It's so ecstatic, and there's something very liminal about being a person who lived, who becomes sainted, who experiences sainthood, which is really kind of what being a Lua in this circumstance means. regarding her.
Thank you. are listening to the LMC Radio Network, whose art and information may be found on its webcast shows. The LMC Radio Network is a community radio alliance of metaphysical, spiritual, inspirational, and political justice broadcasters spanning a wide range of topics. Tune in Sundays for the Lucky Mojo Hoodoo Rootwork Hour, hosted by Catherine Ironwood and Conjurman Ali. It features panel discussions on traditional African-American hoodoo spellcasting with members of the Association of Independent Readers and Rootworkers, plus free readings and magical rootwork advice for live call-in clients. The longest-running conjure show in the universe, it may be heard from 3 o'clock to 4:30 Pacific Time, Sunday afternoons. On Mondays, get ready for Candelo's Corner, starring Candelo Cambisa. This is the meeting place for all esoteric traditions. Candelo brings his insight as a Polero and eclectic spiritualist to his interviews with peers in Afro-Caribbean lineages, as well as representatives of numerous other spiritualities and religions. You can hear Candelo's Corner Monday evenings from 5 to 7 Pacific Time. Tuesdays feature two wonderful shows to suit your taste. On the Crystal Silence League Hour, John St. Germain provides spiritual guidance and tips on the practical use of crystals and crystal balls. His show starts at 5 p.m. Pacific Time and lasts for 1 hour. Next is In the Streets with Beverly Smith. Beverly provides up-to-the-minute reports on civil and social rights issues. Her one-hour show airs on Tuesday evenings at 6 p.m. Pacific Time. On Wednesday nights, come out and join Liquid Libations. Andrea Weston hosts this informal sharing and showcasing of poetry, short stories, and spoken word performances, contributed by novices and professional wordsmiths. Call in and read your work. Liquid Libations may be heard on Wednesdays from 5 to 7 p.m. Pacific Time. On Thursdays, it's the Now You Know Show with Professor Porterfield. In a variety show laced with country wit and biblical wisdom, the professor shares his knowledge of roots, delivers the lucky numbers, and explores the secrets of scriptural sorcery. From 6 to 7:30 p.m. Pacific Time, there's no end to the surprises. All shows on the LMC Radio Network are sponsored by the Lucky Mojo Curio Company, located in Forestville, California, and online at luckymojo.com. Add 3 hours for Eastern, tax and license may apply, train departure times and Burma shape signs subject to change without notice. LMC.
Lucky Mojo Curio Company is based in sunny Forestville, California, and provides traditional spiritual products for remediating all kinds of conditions. Locate them online at luckymojo.com or visit them in person to see the world's smallest church, Missionary Independent Spiritual Church. We are back on sacred ground. I'm your host, Kai Armand, LMC Radio Network, and a little fix to the previously recorded network schedule. Obviously, On Sacred Ground is now broadcasting live at 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern on Wednesday nights, because we have switched with Liquid Libations, which is now at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific on Saturdays. That is 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific on Saturdays. If you want to tune into the lovely Andrea Weston and her poetic musings and her many wonderful, talented gifts. We have been talking about the power of ritual and ceremony, as well as their necessity. We're coming close to the end of the show. I wanted to share another quote from author and Dagara elder, Maladoma Somme, who in his book, The Healing Wisdom of Africa, Finding Life Purpose Through Nature, Ritual, and Community, says, "Ritual, communally designed, helps the individual remember his or her purpose, and such remembering brings healing both to the individual and the community. The community exists, in part, to safeguard the purpose of each person within it, and to awaken the memory of that purpose by recognizing the unique gifts each individual brings to this world. Healing comes when the individual remembers his or her identity, the purpose chosen in the world of ancestral wisdom, and reconnects with that world of spirit. Human beings long for connection, and our sense of usefulness derives from the feeling of connectedness. When we are connected to our own purpose, to the community around us, and to our spiritual wisdom, we are able to live and act with authentic effectiveness. We've been coming around in this idea again of ritual holding space for orderly disorder. And the more recent experience that I had of that was a ritual that was planned by witchcraft priestess Courtney Weber here in New York, who we actually had on the show interviewing her about her book on Bridget some time back. And she is the head of the coven Novices of the Old Ways. And some months ago, when it wasn't the most recent black male shot dead by, police. This was actually one or two black men back. this was actually, I believe, right when the bombings had and burning of churches had really sprung up. And this is actually, just as I'm catching my mind here, this was when the young man had shut up a church in the South. And she felt very moved to have some kind of ritual of healing and asked myself and my partner to take part. And she made it known, and I think we had about 10 to 12 people come. And the idea of the ritual was that, the original idea was that we were going to be gathering, and at some point, after having a talking circle so that people could sort of air their feelings and grievances and pain, we would journey. We would journey to our helping spirits and ask them, how do I contribute to oppression? Come out of the journey and give that over to Grandfather Fire. Give that over to the element of fire, asking for fire to take that away as we would come up with some new commitment, in place of the way in which we all, in some way, were complicit with systems of oppression. And if you don't believe that you are complicit in systems of oppression, you are wrong. We are all complicit in the systems of oppression in some form or fashion, or at least the vast amount of us. If you're listening to this show and you have the privilege to listen to this show because of, technology, not saying that listening to me is a privilege, technological and class privilege to listen to this show, then there are probably some ways that you are complicit in systemic oppression. I know I am. So we're having this talking circle around the fire that we built, the sort of bonfire in the backyard of a local occult shop. And people are passing around a stick that someone had so that we could do this in an orderly fashion. And then there are tears, and there are old memories of racist things said and racist things family members said and of racist things seen but not spoken to or called out. And I'm sitting here, and I'm staring at the fire, and again, this is a story that I might have shared here, but this fire changes. And this fire that's burning up these sticks changes into a fire that's burning up a cross. Actually, it looked more like the roof of a building at first. And I hear the fire tell me, hey, I'm the same fire that burns down churches all over the South. And I said, no, that's really deep fire. What's going on here? And I watched that roof in the fire turn into a cross. And the fire said, I'm also the same fire that's used to light crosses throughout the South on children's lawns, scaring little black girls and making them believe that they don't deserve to be here. And I didn't know what to do with this information because fire, we had really made fire the center of this ritual. And here fire was sort of saying, I do all the things that you guys are upset about. And I say, fire, what are you saying to me? And fire says, oh, I'm just letting you know that I burn up whatever you put me to. If you want to keep me using me to terrorize each other, okay. If you want to find some other way to use me, okay. I'm just letting you know that I burn up whatever you put me to. And in this moment, I actually experienced a minor possession by one of my helping spirits, who is a trickster spirit, a crazy logic teacher, who is really, really good at upending situations. We want to talk about orderly disorder. So we're having this sort of time of grieving and deep emotional release. And she comes in laughing and singing. And she sings a song that goes, "The fire's going to burn, the fire's going to burn. Hi-ho, the dare you, the fire's going to burn. Sing it with me." And upends the whole conversation to make us realize that when it came to the conversation of oppression, we're already setting all the fires. We've been setting fires. We've been, you know, firing guns. We're spewing hate. We're tearing. There's a lot of fire, misused fire, going on already. And that maybe what we needed most was really the element of water, the energy of reconciliation. One of the songs that we sing in one of my communities goes, "The ocean refuses no river. The ocean refuses no river, no river. The ocean refuses no river, no river." And isn't that the song we need to be singing right now? So we thank Grandfather Fire as we put the fire out and pull out a cauldron of water. And we each added drops of healing and blessing oils to it, asking that we might step into a place of reconciliation and healing where there was too much fire, where there's been too much drought, where there's been too much resistance, where there's been too much refusing of each other. And over in the chat room, Troll Towel had even mentioned the drought going on here in California that I've been aware of, as friends of mine that have been sort of spiritually trying to add their intentions towards remediating it. We are, and there's a drought going on in New Jersey too. There's a drought going on in our lives. There's a drought going on in our lives, and we are a young and fire-obsessed culture. And maybe it's really time that we lean into that yin and the power and energy of water. Water, which refuses no river. Water, which flows into water and finds its way. Water, which takes the shape of whatever container it's put into. I'm going to share that story just too, and I feel like I probably showed that story before. But I share that story again just to speak of that, the power of ritual and of that space of creating and then letting go. Creating and then letting go so that spirit and those forces that we've called in can really move us toward what is needed. So that real change, the change we're looking for, even though we don't know what we're looking for, can happen. This has been another episode of On Sacred Ground with your host, Kai Armand. Tune in next week, next Wednesday night, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, as we continue to go deep into the heart of the human experience. Until then, keep a light in your window for courage in our times. I'll be keeping a light in mine. Be blessed.